that after leaving the body, after attaining liberation, the spirit soul will, the individual, the spirit soul will merge into Brahman. Is that the merging, what the impersonalists describe as merging into the impersonal Brahman? But all this laughing and playing of this?
No. The point is that was made in this quote from the Chandogya Upanishad, that the liberated soul, one who is truly liberated, in fact, I can read it again, the translation. Or maybe I should paraphrase it so that it's a little easier to understand. The statement is that the soul who is liberated is liberated by the grace of the Uttama Purusha, the Supreme Person, and he passes through the highest light, Param Jyoti. And the Mukta, the liberated soul, moves about there, within that light, within that luminous spiritual realm, laughing, playing, and rejoicing with women, with carriages, with other Muktas of his own period, or of the past kalpas. So great is his ecstasy that he does not remember even the person standing near him, nor even his own body. So, this is describing his attainment of his svarup. Svarup means his own spiritual form, his spiritual world. So, this is also in the Isopanishad. There's that verse, Hiranmayina Patrina Satyasya Apita Mukham, the prayer to the Lord that you may remove, please remove your effulgence so that I can see your face. So when one enters the spiritual world, he passes through the luminous sphere of Brahman, the Brahma Jyoti. But if he's a devotee, then he will ultimately come to the realm of Vaikuntha, and if he's graced with Krishna Prema, then he will enter Goloka, the highest point of Vaikuntha. Are there any other questions? Yes?
Yesterday you also explained that everything is emanating out of the Brahma Jyoti, but also including the jivas, the living entity. Are we consciousness of Krishna as Brahma Jyoti is the impersonal form of Krishna and not his personal form? When there is a first time of emanating as jiva, consciousness of Krishna? Or is that maybe why we have a fall down?
I see you're sneaking in this question again. Well, I'm not going to... That's a whole subject matter. But I will just say that in Krishna's statements in the 11th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, in the Uddhava Gita, actually I have it. I have it, but I don't think I have it with me here. I have the... It comes later on in this presentation.
No.
Well, I haven't finished answering her question. But in the 11th canto, yes, in the next days we'll actually read this verse, or one of two verses. There are two verses right next to each other, where Krishna says that when the soul attains liberation through bhakti yoga, then he returns. The example is given just like gold. Gold may be corrupted. It may become mixed with other elements. But if you place it in fire, then the other elements are consumed in the fire and it becomes pure gold. So Krishna says, just like that, when the soul, the jiva, is placed within the fire of bhakti yoga, then he becomes pure again. And it clearly says he regains his original form. And then that is also further confirmed in the next verse. So there's two verses in the 11th canto, directly spoken by Krishna, where he says the original state of the jiva is that he has a form and he's engaged in devotional service to the Supreme Lord. So this is the statement of Shastra. And Prabhupada explained in this way. There is some controversy There's some disciples of Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati who have argued that the jiva comes from the Brahma Jyoti. So we can say that the jiva passes through Brahma Jyoti. And from this side, it's just like Ramanujacharya has given the example of a green bird entering a green tree. When one sees, if one could perceive from the point of view of material world, seeing the living entity leave this universe, it would appear that he merges into the light of Brahman. But he says, it is like a green bird entering a green tree. You stand outside, you see the bird fly into the green tree, it seems to disappear inside the tree. But you know, with some little intelligence, you can understand he's there inside the tree, he's sitting on a branch, he's enjoying fruits in the tree, he's there in his own form. So then you take that example in reverse. If the green bird flies out of the green tree, you know, it will appear like suddenly he emanated out of the greenness of the tree, but actually he came from within the tree. So in the same way, when the living entities fall down from the spiritual world, it will appear that they come out of Brahma Jyoti, but they're just passing through it. Yes?
You mentioned that super soul, that super soul is the Jagya, is the result of Jagya.
Jagya Purusha.
Jagya Purusha. Does that mean all Jagyas, in the sense of, you know, is that referred to by Sankata Jagya, and you know, all other types of like Jagya, like for example, it said that Krishna says, I'll sacrifice some chanting the holy name in Japa and Bhagavad Gita. So, how's that relation?
No, but actually, that was the major point of what we were saying yesterday, that sacrifice is there. There's Vedic sacrifice. And there may be even non-Vedic sacrifices. But the whole point is that one should remember Krishna. Even in Vedic sacrifice, if one does not remember Krishna, then one does not get the full transcendental benefit of engaging in Vedic sacrifices. So it is, you know, just like austerity. We are forced in this material world to engage in austerity. Even if we're just sense gratifiers to maintain this body, you have to perform austerity. The karmis, they're working hard, they're suffering like anything. But because it's not for Krishna, it's useless. That type of austerity pushes them down. They're making sacrifices, but all of this just pushes them down. They're just being plundered by these activities. So the whole thing is, as Prabhupada would say, to change the account, to do it for Krishna. So, and that's the message of Bhagavad Gita, to Arjuna is being told by Krishna to do everything, do his duty for him.
Is this specifically like, you know, the form of the super soul? But is that like just a generalization, in other words, it's Krishna, or is it that particular form is mentioned as the Jagya Purusha?
Yeah, well, if one is a devotee of Krishna, if one has loving feelings for Krishna, then his loving feelings are accepted by Krishna, because super soul, as I said, is the form of Krishna who accepts our sacrifice. You see, in the Vedic context of civilization, sacrifices are prescribed for human beings. So they sacrifice. It may be that they're sacrificing out of duty. You know, just like Varnashram, it's a social system. So you know how societies work, like Karmi society. There are laws. There are official state laws, and then there's also kind of like there are religious laws, and then there's a sort of unspoken social law. You know, you're just expected to dress in a certain way, act in a certain way in public. So everyone's under this restriction and expectation, and it becomes mechanical, you know? So in Varnashram culture, someone can perform sacrifices in a sort of mechanical way, but he's hoping the Lord, maybe he's even thinking whoever he is, he's not so clear on who the Lord is, But he's hoping the Lord will, he's praying to the Lord, he's chanting mantras to the Lord to accept them. So that Lord is Paramatma. Paramatma is specifically there to accept sacrifice. But it can be done mechanically, ritualistically. He will accept and he will reciprocate. If the person is doing the rituals, even he's addressing Paramatma directly, but he has some goal in mind to go to the heavenly planets, then Paramatma will reciprocate. He, after the death of this body, Paramatma will lead him to the heavenly planets according to his pious activities, or liberation. But it's when we have, when we develop love of Krishna, love of Krishna, the original personality of Godhead, then he reciprocates by showing his original two-handed form, just like he did to Arjuna. Arjuna was not satisfied even with seeing four-handed Vishnu. And only when he saw the two-handed, we read that verse, the two-handed form of the Lord, did he say, now I am restored to my original nature. So, it's nice to see you have questions, but I think we have to move on.
Just a technical question. Yesterday you talked about this verse from the
Chandogya Upanishad.
About the Mukti not being personal, and I looked at 15:19 Gita, it wasn't there, so it's important for me to get this reference. If it's at hand, otherwise it's
not. You looked in Bhagavad Gita 15:18. Mm-hmm. Srila Prabhupada's Bhagavad Gita as it is. I'll read from the purport. In the purport, it says, the following verse appears in the Vedas, Chandogya Upanishad, 8.12.3. And then there's a quote. Now, the complete quote is not there, that I explained yesterday. You found it, huh?
Yes.
The thing is that the full verse, which I looked up in the Vedanta Sutra commentary of Baladeva Vidyabhusan, it does not appear completely in this purport, but at least you have the reference. Chandogya Upanishad 8.12.3. That's the reference.
Thank you.
Alright, so let us continue. Now we're going to go to the second essence of the Gita, Chatur Shloki. Bhagavad Gita, chapter 10, text 8, 9, 10, and 11. Just like in Srimad Bhagavatam, in the second canto, there are four verses which are called Chatur Shloki of Bhagavatam. These were spoken by Krishna to Brahma before the creation. And in these are called, Prabhupada calls the four nutshell verses of Bhagavatam. From these four verses, the entire meaning of Bhagavatam emanates. So similarly, the Chatur Shloki of the Bhagavad Gita contains the essence of God realization. Krishna is teaching Arjuna God realization in Bhagavad Gita. So in these four verses, you'll find the essence of how to realize God. So we shall read Bhagavad Gita, chapter 10, text 8. These are very famous verses. Generally, most devotees, if they've been around for a few months, they have learned these four verses. Aham savasya prabhavo matak sarvam pavartate iti matva bhajanti mam buddha bhava samanvitaha. I am the source of all spiritual and material worlds. Everything emanates from me. The wise who perfectly know this engage in my devotional service and worship me with all their hearts. So, in this opening statement, Aham Savasya Prabhavo Matak Sarvam Pavartate, which means Aham is I, Savasya, of all, Prabhava, the source of generation, Matak, from me, sarvam, everything, pravartate, emanates. So I am the source of all spiritual and material worlds, everything emanates from me. So, in this line of this verse, Krishna is, in just a few words, he's revealing his vibhuti. Now, Krishna goes into great detail talking about his vibhuti. Vibhuti means opulence. The opulence that he displays within this material existence. So, later in this same chapter, chapter 10, texts 20 to 39, you can look at these later. But here Krishna enunciates to Arjuna, because Arjuna asked, after hearing this statement, Arjuna will ask Krishna, tell me more about your opulences, your divine opulences. So in verses 10 to, oh, sorry, 20 to 39, Krishna enunciates in greater detail what he means by Hamsa Vasha Prabhavo. Also in the ninth chapter, 16 to 19, Krishna reveals a little bit about his opulences there too. So, this is important because here Krishna is explaining why he is the Uttama Purusha. Yesterday we concluded, hearing Tri Shloki, that Krishna is the Purushottama. So here Krishna is explaining the proof. Or he's, and in the 11th chapter he will actually demonstrate his vibhuti. So we'll come back to this theme in a little while about you can know God by his vibhuti. Now we will look at the purport. Srila Prabhupada writes, a learned scholar who has studied the Vedas perfectly and has information from authorities like Lord Chaitanya and who knows how to apply these teachings can understand that Krishna is the origin of everything in both the material and spiritual worlds. And because he knows this perfectly, he becomes firmly fixed in the devotional service of the Supreme Lord. He can never be deviated by any amount of nonsensical commentaries or by fools. Lord Krishna is the source of all generations, and he is called the most efficient cause of everything. He says, because everything is born of me, I am the original source of all. Everything is under me, no one is above me. There is no supreme controller other than Krishna. Now, Prabhupada writes here, a learned scholar who has studied the Vedas perfectly. So what Prabhupada means here is a Vedantist. So this is a very nice progression now from the Tri Shloki. This is why I've arranged this presentation in this way. We first looked at the Tri Shloki from the 15th chapter, and then we come back to this 10th chapter. Because in this verse, Bhagavad Gita 10:8, Sri Krishna is explaining how a Vedantist, a learned scholar who has studied the Vedas perfectly, how he should move beyond intellectual theory to practical realization of the Absolute Truth. Because Vedanta means a philosopher, but Vedantist is a philosopher. He studied the Vedas from authorities, he has a theoretical grasp of the meaning of the Vedas. So he's very wise. But, as will be seen in this Chatur Shloki, it is not simply knowledge alone, at least the knowledge which comes within our grasp. It's not by that type of knowledge that one can realize Krishna. Krishna reveals himself. So, now how Krishna reveals himself, that is the subject matter of these four verses. So here's a quote from Srila Prabhupada. Krishna says that Mata Paratram Nanyat, there is no more superior existence than myself. Aham Savasya Prabhava, I am the origin. Janmadyasya Yataha, this is from Vedanta. This verse, this code of the Vedanta Sutra, is explained by Krishna himself that I am the origin of everything. So Krishna, in this verse, is giving the purport to Vedanta Sutra. That all these Vedantists, these jnanis, these meditators, these researchers, these thinkers, they're all just looking for me. They're looking for the source of everything. It is me. And you have to keep in mind, this is Krishna speaking to Arjuna. You see, there they are in the same chariot. Arjuna is Krishna's friend. And Krishna is telling Arjuna that all these jnanis, yogis, they're just Vedantists, they're just looking for me. How fortunate you are, Arjuna. that you're here with me on this chariot. Here's another quote. Now we're getting an indication from this quote how Krishna can be realized by that learned Vedantist. Something has to be added to his knowledge. Krishna also explains, Aham savasya prabhava matak sarvam pavartate iti matva bhajanti mam buddha bhava samanvita. With ecstatic love, they worship Krishna. Bhajanti mam. You see, Buddha. Buddha in this verse means intelligence or knowledge, wisdom. Bhava means ecstasy, ecstatic love. So, iti matva bhajanti. Bhajanti means worship. So they worship Krishna. They know Krishna by their scholarly research, their perfect study of the Vedas. They've come to know who Krishna is. They've identified that Krishna is that source of everything. So now they worship Him. But Buddha Bhava, Bhava, with love. Here's another quote from Srila Prabhupada. Yes, this is actually the essence of Bhagavad Gita. Aham savasya prabhavo matak sarvam pravartate. I am the origin of everything. Aham savasya prabhavo and matak sarvam. Sarva means including Brahma, Vishnu, Maheshwara. Sarvam. Matak sarvam. Pravartate iti matva. One who understands this, bhajante. So just, this bhajan is for whom? Iti matva. When one understands that Krishna is the origin of everything, even the original demigods, Brahma, Vishnu, Maheshwara, when one understands perfectly this thing, then his bhajan, his worship, is perfect. And then someone else says, Buddha bhava samanvita. And Prabhupada replies, bhava, bhava. Bhava means love. Feelings. Feelings of love. Oh, Krishna is so great. Now this is important. Scholars, intellectuals, philosophers, they're not usually known for their feelings. They're all analysis, you see. But they're not very famous for their heartfelt feelings. So what Krishna is saying here is that must be there. There must be heartfelt, loving feelings for Him. Now this stage of transition between jnana, impersonal jnana, just perceiving the Absolute as impersonal light, and coming to an understanding of the person Krishna, and beginning to feel some love and loving respect for Krishna, at least as Prabhupada says here, oh, Krishna is so great. That takes place in which rasa? Who can tell us? Yes, Mataji? Shanta rasa. Yes, so it's in the Shanta rasa that the personal conception of God manifests. And there is some bhava there. Bhava of respect. Just as Prabhupada expressed it here. Oh, Krishna is so great. This is how it begins. So this has to be the conclusion of all this Vedanta scholarship. I'll just mention some verses. I'm not going to read them, but I'll mention the numbers, chapter references and verse numbers. These are Krishna's statements about wise men surrendering to Him. So Bhagavad Gita 7.18, Bhagavad Gita 7.3, 4.10, 18.54, 7.19. These are some of Krishna's statements about wise men surrendering to Him. And just like Krishna says in 4.10, being freed from attachment, fear and anger. This is a good example of these verses. Being freed from attachment, fear and anger. That means they become purified. Being fully absorbed in me and taking refuge in me. Many, many persons in the past became purified by knowledge of me. And thus they all attained transcendental love of me. So now, Prabhupada writes in the purport, in this purport, only a fool would consider Krishna to be an ordinary man. A wise man, one who is Buddha, he understands the Lord's vibhuti, the Lord's opulence, that He is the source of everything. That He is, as Krishna says later in this chapter, He is the strength of the strong, He is the syllable om, He is the, His eye is the sun, and so on and so forth, all these depictions of the Lord's Vibhuti. Finally, he says, with just a fragment of myself, I am maintaining all these universes. This is his Vibhuti. So after understanding this, then how could anyone consider Krishna to be an ordinary man? He must be a fool. So who can think of a famous verse from Bhagavad Gita where Krishna speaks of such fools? Mm-hmm. Yes. This, fools deride me when I descend in the human form. They do not know my transcendental nature as the Supreme Lord of all that be. And there's another verse, actually we've already mentioned. Unintelligent men who do not know me perfectly think that I, the Supreme Personality of Godhead Krishna, was impersonal before and have now assumed this personality. Due to their small knowledge, they do not know my higher nature, which is imperishable and supreme. This is again 7:24. So this is the philosophy of such fools, that the Absolute is impersonal, but once in a while he becomes a person by assuming a material body. So Prabhupada would say, so if Krishna has a material body, if Krishna is actually in his form no different from you or I, then what is the use of his Gita? What is the use of his speaking Bhagavad Gita? That's a very, very deep statement. We don't have time to get into all the ramifications of Mayavadi philosophy. But we can just say, if the Supreme Truth is actually formless, then what is the use of saying anything about it? Because all these words are, they themselves are forms of sound. So if form is Maya, then whatever you speak with this mouth, which is a form of matter, any sound coming out of it, which is a form of matter, is also Maya. So that means Krishna's Gita is all useless. And yet the impersonalists, they're trying to prove their impersonalism by quoting the Bhagavad Gita. So there's a big contradiction here. So Duryodhana is such a fool. When Krishna came as a last attempt to stop the war, the impending war between the Pandavas and the Kauravas, Krishna came to Hastinapur personally. And he first of all, he asked Maharaj Dhritarashtra to return Indraprastha, which was half of the kingdom of the Kaurava dynasty. Because Dhritarashtra had divided the kingdom to settle the conflict between his sons and the five Pandavas. And then that half had been improperly taken from the Pandavas by this cheating dice match. And when the Pandavas returned after 12 years of exile and 1 year of incognito, then Duryodhana, he refused to return Indraprastha again. So that was the cause. That was the cause of the impending war. So Sri Krishna, first of all, he requested, you give back Indraprastha to the Pandavas. And Maharaj Dhritarashtra, he refused. Actually, it was Duryodhana who refused, and Maharaj Dhritarashtra is so much under his control that he could not defy his own son. So then Krishna asked, just give them 5 villages, because they're Kshatriyas, they have to rule over land. So give them 5 villages. And then Duryodhana jumped up and he said, I won't give them even as much land as you can drive in a pin. Even that much land, I'll not yield to them. So then Krishna said, all right, well, then the issue is settled. And Duryodhana, very impudently, he called for the guard to arrest Krishna in a very impudent way. He said, arrest this cowherd! What is he doing here anyway, speaking on behalf of the Pandavas, our enemies? So he was, you know, calling Krishna an ordinary coward, thinking that his palace guards could arrest him. So when the palace guards closed in around Krishna, then Krishna revealed there his universal form. So, but out of that assembly, you see, it was only Grandfather Bhishma, it was Dronacharya, and a few others who were devotees of the Lord, they were very happy to see the Lord's vibhuti, to see the Lord displaying for everyone his opulence as the Supreme Personality of Godhead. But still, Duryodhana and his crooked uncle, what was his name?
Shakuni.
Shakuni, yes, Shakuni. And others around him, these crooked persons. Later on, they were considering that it was just some magic, just some illusion he was showing, just to bewilder everyone. So Duryodhana is such a fool. And of course, in the Mahabharata, he stands out for his foolishness. He stands out. He's depicted in Mahabharata as being such a, you know, such a stupid person, such a wrong-headed person, who by his stubbornness, he destroyed the whole Kaurava dynasty by leading it into war. But nowadays we have so many fools. The world is full of such fools. And they will, you know, now we have, like in India, there's a famous so-called, for his mystic opulences, is that he makes a little ash come out of his hand. And sometimes it comes out of pictures. And this is what these followers of this person, they call vibhuti. Vibhuti means mystic opulence. So a little ash will do now. For the mudhas of the modern age. Well, that's enough. Oh, he is God. But Krishna displays his universal form. So going on to the next verse, Bhagavad Gita 10:9. Another very famous verse, worth learning if you don't know it. Machita matgata prana bodhyanta parasparam kotayantas chamam nityam tushanti cha ramanti cha. The thoughts of my pure devotees dwell in me, their lives are fully devoted to my service, and they derive great satisfaction and bliss from always enlightening one another and conversing about me. So Prabhupada writes in the purport, the symptoms of the pure devotees are described in this verse specifically. Devotees of the Supreme Lord are 24 hours daily engaged in glorifying the qualities and pastimes of the Supreme Lord. Now there's a famous verse about this in the 9th chapter. You must know. Satatam kirtayantam. Yes. So Krishna there in 9:13 and 14, that's 9:14. Krishna is describing the Mahatmas, his pure devotees. O son of Pita, those who are not deluded, the great souls, the Mahatmas, they are under the protection of the divine nature. This is very important, because we have been explained, we've been hearing how Krishna is the origin of everything. You see, he is the origin of everything. So that means everything having its origin in him is divine, his Daivi Shakti. So, those who are not deluded by this Daivi Shakti, who can see that Aham Savasya Prabhava, as Krishna says, he is the origin of everything, who can actually see this, then they are under the protection of Krishna's Shakti. Where the others who are ignorant, who are foolish, they're bewildered by this Shakti. So for them, this Shakti is called Maya, Mahamaya. And for the devotee, it is Yoga Maya. So they are under the protection of the divine nature. They are fully engaged in devotional service because they know me as the Supreme Personality of Godhead, original and inexhaustible, always chanting my glories, endeavoring with great determination, bowing down before me, these great souls perpetually worship me with devotion. So going on in the purport, in the preliminary stage of devotional service, they relish the transcendental pleasure from the service itself. And in the mature stage, they're actually situated in love of God. When situated in that transcendental position, they can relish the highest perfection, which is exhibited by the Lord in His abode. Now, to explain this, I've gotten this quote from a work by Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur called Madhurya Kadambani, The point again, just to paraphrase, is that in the preliminary stage of devotional service, the devotees derive this bliss, tushanti cha ramanti cha, this satisfaction and bliss from the service. But in the higher stage, in the mature stage, they can understand that the bliss that they're experiencing in devotional service is actually the bliss of associating with Krishna. In the beginning stage, on the sadhana bhakti platform, for instance, when we chant the holy name, we feel bliss, but we may not understand that Krishna and His name are identical. We think by chanting, I am serving Krishna. But you see, Krishna and His holy name are the same. So actually the bliss is coming from associating directly with Krishna. But we are unable to see that perhaps. So from the Madhurya Kandamani, this is a very nice explanation. When the golden coin of bhakti, devotion, shining effulgently by the fire of steady practice and propelled by its own energy, becomes fixed in the devotee's heart, ruchi, or taste for devotional activities, appears. When a person develops a taste for the activities of bhakti, such as hearing and chanting, which is vastly greater than attraction to anything else, that is called ruchi. Unlike the previous stages, at the stage of ruchi, constant performance of hearing and chanting does not result in even the least fatigue. Ruchi quickly produces a great attachment to the activities of bhakti. This is similar to a Brahmana boy who, after diligently studying the scriptures daily and in time grasping the meaning, finds no difficulties at all in applying himself to study and moreover develops a pleasure in the task. So in other words, there's an English statement, practice makes perfect. We say in German, Übung macht Meister, right? Yeah. So by practice one becomes proficient at something. So the same is in devotional service. The stages that are being mentioned here, they begin with shraddha. There's some simple faith through association with devotees. Adau shraddha tata sadhu sangha. One gets a little faith by seeing devotees, seeing their activities. So then he takes up the association of devotees. Then he becomes initiated into the process of devotional service. And then by that engagement in devotional service, he overcomes his anarthas. Anarthas means the tendency for sinful activity in the heart. So these anarthas that hold us back, when Prabhupada writes here that at the ruchi platform, there is no fatigue. You see, when we feel some fatigue from chanting Hare Krishna, sometimes when we're chanting our rounds and we want to finish, you see, and we look at our counting beads and we see we've only done 12 rounds, there's 4 more to go. And we think, oh, how long is this going to take? I'm so tired of chanting, I want to do something else. So this type of attitude is arising from anarthas. This means we have still in our heart seeds of material desire. And they're hampering our spiritual taste. But by steady practice, these anarthas are washed away. And then one comes to the platform, the next platform, ruchi. Ruchi means devotional service, which is unhampered. Which, like it is stated here very nicely, propelled by its own energy. There's nothing more holding it back. You know, it's like if you're trying to walk somewhere, but you have a big chain, ball and chain. You know, like they keep the prisoners in the prison house shackled to a ball and chain. So they can make some movement, they can move around the prison yard, but they have to carry this big ball. They can't move very fast. So when that is cut, these anarthas are cut, then one can move by his own natural speed. So then, yes, one becomes simply accustomed, adapted to chanting, and he derives great pleasure from it. So then, continuing on, after this, when ruchi, taste, which has bhajana, hearing and chanting and other devotional activities, as its object of relish, reaches extreme depth and makes Krishna
the object of relish. That is called ashakti, or attachment. You see? At the stage of ashakti, the creeper of bhakti bears clusters of buds. You know, the bhakti lata, which is growing up. At this stage, just like in a new plant, the stem grows up, and then you see some clusters of the buds of flowers. So this is ashakti. These buds will in no time become flowers at the stage of bhava, ecstasy, and then fruits at the stage of prema. The statement that ruchi has bhajan as the object and ashakti has the Lord as the object is a designation signifying proportionate quantity. Actually, both ruchi and ashakti have both components as objects, but by less intensity in taking bhajan as object and greater intensity in taking the Lord as object, ashakti becomes distinguishable from ruchi. Ashakti polishes the mirror of the heart to such a condition that a reflection of the Lord may suddenly be visible there. Before the stage of ashakti, the devotee, realizing that his mind has been overpowered by material objects and desires, after putting forth a deliberate effort, withdraws his mind and fixes it on the Lord's form, qualities, and activities. In the stage of ashakti, however, absorption of the mind in the Lord is automatic without effort. So you know, Lord Chaitanya, in his first Shiksha Ashtakam, which I think you're studying, he says, Cheto Darpana Marjanam, this process of chanting cleanses the mirror of the heart. So it is at the stage of ashakti that this mirror becomes so clean that one can suddenly have the darshan of the Lord within the heart. So then one actually realizes that, oh, here is the object of all my efforts. What time is it now? 8:25. Okay, we have a little more time. Prabhupada writes in the purport, continuing, Lord Chaitanya likens the transcendental devotional service to the sowing of a seed in the heart of the living entity. There are innumerable living entities traveling throughout the different planets of the universe, and out of them there are few who are fortunate enough to meet a pure devotee and get the chance to understand devotional service. This devotional service is just like a seed, and if it is sown in the heart of the living entity, and if he goes on hearing and chanting, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ram, Hare Ram, Ram Ram, Hare Hare, that seed fructifies, just as the seed of a tree fructifies with regular watering. The spiritual plant of devotional service gradually grows and grows until it penetrates the covering of the material universe and enters into the Brahmajyoti effulgence in the spiritual sky. In the spiritual sky also, that plant grows more and more until it reaches the highest planet, which is called Goloka Vrindavan, the supreme planet of Krishna. Ultimately, the plant takes shelter under the lotus feet of Krishna and rests there. Gradually, as a plant grows fruits and flowers, that plant of devotional service also produces fruits, and the watering process in the form of chanting and hearing goes on. This plant of devotional service is fully described in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, Madhya Lila, chapter 19. It is explained there that when the complete plant takes shelter under the lotus feet of the Supreme Lord, one becomes fully absorbed in love of God, then he cannot live even for a moment without being in contact with the Supreme Lord, just as a fish cannot live without water. In such a state, the devotee actually attains the transcendental qualities in contact with the Supreme Lord. So, now, another point that's being made in this verse, which is describing the devotees and their association. The devotees of the Lord gather together to hear and chant about Him. In this way, they relish His association. So another point that's being made here is that a wise man, one who has understood theoretically that Krishna is the absolute truth and who wants to actually devote himself to the Lord and realize the Lord, he has to take the association of the Lord's devotees in order to become perfect in Krishna consciousness. Now, I found something very nice in the Svetashvatara Upanishad. Because again, these Upanishads we mentioned yesterday, they're the scriptures for those who are jnanis. But Still, the Upanishads, they point, ultimately, they point the jnanis to bhakti. After the jnanis have, you know, absorbed their minds fully in the mysterious statements of the Upanishads, and have finally understood that the Supreme Absolute Truth is personal, is a person, then the Upanishads, they point the jnani to take up bhakti. And I can give an illustration of this from the Svetashvatara Upanishad. Here's the first verse. It starts off, Hari Om. The Brahmavadis say, what is the first, the great cause? From where were we born? How do we remain alive? Where do we go at death? O knowers of Brahman, by whose will are we subject to pleasure and pain? So this is how the Svetashvatara Upanishad opens, with these deep philosophical inquiries. And then the last verse, after so much philosophy is discussed, this is the last verse, this is the conclusion. This is a famous verse you find all throughout Prabhupada's books. Yasya devi parabhaktir, yata devi tathagaro, tasyaiti katiti hyarta prakashante mahatmana. Only unto those great souls who have implicit faith in both the Lord and the spiritual master are all the imports of Vedic knowledge automatically revealed. So that's the conclusion. You have to get spiritual master, and from him you have to learn how to worship the Lord. And this way all this knowledge will be revealed to you. So this is the beginning of bhakti. So one, in other words, one has to associate with these great devotees who are relishing Krishna consciousness. And of course, in the fourth chapter of Bhagavad Gita, verses 25-33, Sri Krishna describes the various sacrifices of yogis, mystics, renunciates, and philosophers to attain transcendental knowledge. That's in verses 25-33. Huh? Fourth chapter. Then in verse 34, you must know this verse. 4:34. He gives his own opinion. After he describes all their efforts, then he gives his own opinion about how transcendental knowledge is to be attained. And what is that? Yes. You have to approach a spiritual master. Just try to learn the truth by approaching a spiritual master, inquire from him submissively, and render service unto him. The self-realized soul can impart knowledge unto you because they have seen the truth. And here's another statement from Mahabharata, Avana Parva. 313-117. Dry arguments are inconclusive. A muni whose opinion does not differ from others is not considered a great sage. Simply by studying the Vedas, which are variegated, one cannot come to the right path by which religious principles are understood. The solid truth of religious principles is hidden in the heart of an unadulterated self-realized person. Consequently, as the Shastras confirm, one should accept whatever progressive path the Mahajans advocate. Mahajano yena katasa panta. So all these other methods of argument, of research, of, you know, and different munis with their different ideas going from speculator to speculator, hearing this opinion, that opinion, it is all rejected. You have to come into the association of Mahajans. And who are these Mahajans? As again we know from Bhagavad Gita 9th chapter, they are the devotees of the Lord who are satatam kirtayantumam, always engaged in glorifying Krishna. Now, here's a quote from Srila Prabhupada. So Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu also advised, Jnane prayasham udapasya namanteva. Give up the false speculation of understanding God in your calculation. Just become humble and meek. Jnane prayasham udapasya namanteva. San mukaritam bhavadiya vartam. And try to hear about God from realized souls, from Krishna or his bona fide representative. That is very nice qualification. Simply hear. Stani stita shruti katam tanuvan manobir. In this way, you remain in your position. Try to understand how great God is through the authoritative sources. And your life will be so successful that one day, this is a very beautiful statement, listen to this. Your life will be so successful that one day you'll find God is within your hand. It is so nice thing. Just as you keep a child within your hand, just Mother Yashoda kept Krishna within her arms always. You'll also have a similar position simply by hearing about him. You see? Krishna will simply appear within your arms or within your hand. Now, to conclude from this purport, we'll read this. The Srimad Bhagavatam is also full of such narrations about the relationship between the Supreme Lord and His devotees. Therefore, the Srimad Bhagavatam is very dear to the devotees, as stated in the Bhagavatam itself. Srimad Bhagavatam Puranam Amalabhyad Vaishnavam Priyam. In this narration, there is nothing about material activities, economic development, sense gratification, or liberation. Srimad Bhagavatam is the only narration in which the transcendental nature of the Supreme Lord and His devotees is fully described. Thus, the realized souls in Krishna consciousness take continual pleasure in hearing such transcendental literatures, just as a young boy and girl take pleasure in association. So, the Srimad Bhagavatam is the special subject matter of the Rasika Bhaktas, the devotees who have this rasa, this taste for Krishna consciousness. And one can only understand Srimad Bhagavatam properly by hearing it from such devotees. There's a nice narration, nice pastime in the Chaitanya Bhagavata about a great scholar of the Bhagavatam named Devananda Pandit. He was a scholar, but he was not really a devotee. So he knew the Bhagavatam backward and forward. He knew every verse of the Bhagavatam, and he had many disciples. And actually, Srivas Pandit, Srivas Thakur of the Panchatattva, when he was young, he was also a disciple of Devananda, in that he learned the Bhagavatam from him. But Srivas Pandit, he's a Rasika Bhakta. So he was hearing the Bhagavatam in a completely other way. He was hearing it in love of God. Because who is Srivas Pandit? He is Narada Muni, the great devotee. So one time when Srivas came to the ashram of Devananda Pandit in Kulia Gram, this is a subdivision of Navadvip. He came and he sat in the back, and Devananda was reciting the verses of the Bhagavatam. And hearing these verses, Srivas Pandit went into ecstasy. And he began to cry and tremble. And so the other disciples, who all were dry scholars like their guru, they took this as a disturbance. You see, they looked and, what is he doing? Why is he doing all this here? This is not the place for this emotional display. We are learning this very deep philosophical matter. And he's crying and moaning and all this. So they threw him out. They picked him up and they tossed him out of the ashram. So then Srivas thought, well, I'll never go there again. But he forgot the incident. And this incident had happened before Chaitanya Mahaprabhu appeared in this world. So when Lord Chaitanya came back from Gaya, where he had met his spiritual master Ishwara Puri and received from him the holy name, then Lord Chaitanya began the Sankirtan movement. And so he took Sankirtan party all around Navadvip. And everywhere he was bestowing upon the populace of Navadvip pure love of Godhead through the vibration Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ram, Hare Ram, Ram Ram, Hare Hare. So one day he came to Kulia, and the Sankirtan party was approaching the ashram of Devananda. And suddenly Lord Chaitanya stopped the kirtan. So Devananda was just inside the ashram. He was waiting for the kirtan to come by, but then he saw it is stopped. And then Lord Chaitanya turned and he addressed all the devotees. And he said, here we will not make kirtan, because Devananda has offended my devotee, my pure devotee, Srivas Thakur. I declare that for all of his scholarship, Devananda Pandit has no understanding of the Srimad Bhagavatam. He may take birth for millions of lifetimes in the future as a Bhagavatam scholar, but in all of those births, he will never understand the Bhagavatam. And then the Lord left with his devotees. So the Lord denounced him and would not even let him hear his kirtan because he had offended Srivas Thakur. So one may be a scholar of the Bhagavatam, but unless one is graced by this rasa, this tushanti cha ramanti cha, one is relishing the association of devotees, hearing Bhagavatam from devotees of the Lord and taking relish from this, then one can never understand Bhagavatam. So it was not that the story has a happy ending. That actually, Devananda Pandit, he felt bad about this, but because he was a big scholar, he was in that way. He was a little proud, and also, you know, he had disciples who expected him to act in a certain way. So he could not formally go to Lord Chaitanya and ask his forgiveness, but he kept thinking about this, and he didn't feel right about it. So later on, after Lord Chaitanya had taken sannyas and gone to Puri, Navadvip received a visit from one of Lord Chaitanya's great associates, Vrakreshwara Pandit. Now, Vrakreshwara Pandit is an associate of Lord Chaitanya and Lord Nityananda, who actually is endowed with the potencies of Mahaprabhu, so that wherever he would make kirtan, the same Krishna prema was generated as Chaitanya and Nityananda used to generate when they would make kirtan together. So Vrakeshwara Pandit had a big Hare Krishna festival in Navadvip, and Devananda Pandit thought, let me go there. Let me at least try to get his association. So Devananda came there, and he actually did service for Vrakeshwara Pandit, because Devananda was so much respected as a brahmana, important figure in Navadvip, that when Devananda, Vrakeshwara Pandit, he was chanting Hare Krishna, he fell into ecstasy, and he was kind of staggering, and completely blinded by ecstasy, not watching where he was moving. And the crowd in the meantime was pressing in, because they'd become so overwhelmed by waves of Krishna prema coming from Vrakeshwara Pandit. So they were pressing in, and he was stumbling this way and that, so it was a fearful situation. Devananda thought that this crowd may crush Vrakeshwara Pandit. So because he was an important personality, he came before the crowd, and with his stick he pushed them back. And they dared not come any closer because he was there. And then Vrakeshwara Pandit fell down on the ground in ecstasy, and Devananda raised him up and brushed his clothes, brushed the dirt from his cloth. So This was just some simple service he did. So then later on, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu returned as a sannyasi to Navadvip. This was his first attempt to go to Vrindavan. And you may know that Lord Nityananda deliberately misled him and brought him to the Ganges River instead of the Jamuna. And there Advaitacharya met him and took him to his house. And so the residents of Navadvip, they all came. So Devananda Pandit also came. But Devananda was thinking, the Lord is displeased with me, so I'll not come forward like all the others. From a distance, I will offer my obeisances. So he came in. Behind this whole huge crowd, he was bowing down and thinking, I'm not worthy to come any closer. Suddenly he heard Lord Chaitanya calling through this big crowd of people, Devananda, you come here. So the crowd opened and he could come, and he bowed down before the Lord. And Lord Chaitanya said, you are an offender against my devotee Srivas. But because you have rendered service to another one of my devotees, Vrakreshwara Pandit, therefore, I'm just finishing up. They want to hear the end of the story, so I can't stop. Therefore, I'm inclined to give you my mercy. But first you have to beg forgiveness from the lotus feet of Srivas Thakur. Now this is very amazing, because technically Srivas Thakur is the disciple of Devananda Pandit. But Devananda Pandit, because he was now so eager to get Lord Chaitanya's blessing, he fell at the feet of his own disciple and begged him, please forgive me. And Srivas picked him up. No, no, don't fall at my feet. You never committed any offense to me. So in this way, Lord Chaitanya blessed Devananda with this relish. And it was so nice. This is a perfect illustration of what's being described here, because Devananda Pandit was a learned scholar. He was full of buddha, knowledge of Srimad Bhagavatam. And from by the grace of the devotees and Lord Chaitanya, he got that bhava, he got that ecstatic taste. And thus, he could, in the association of devotees, engage in blissful hearing and chanting. And thus, Devananda Pandit, he is known as one of the great associates of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So that is a nice illustration of the point of these first two verses of the Chatur Shloki. So we will go on tomorrow with the second two verses, Chatushloki Gita. Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
Thank you very much.